Hello, and welcome to Batflips and Nerds, the podcast that gives you a British take on baseball. I am, as ever, your host, John McGee. Now, this week is a bit of a special treat. It's our much-trilled interview with Ed Miliband, the former leader of the Labour Party, leader of the opposition, and MP for Doncaster North. The conversation takes in an awful lot of baseball, a lot about the Red Sox, whom Ed is a huge fan of, but also a little bit about how baseball and politics cross over. A couple of notices before we get going, though. Firstly, be sure to check out Ed's own podcast, Reasons to be Cheerful, which you can follow on Twitter, at Cheerful Podcast. He presents that with Jeff Lloyd, and it covers all sorts of different social and political issues. It's really good fun. They get some really great comedians on there, some really great political guests, and people from the world of academia too. It's well worth an hour of your time, and it does always cheer me up when I listen to it. The second thing that I must point out is that towards the end of the audio with Ed, which I've just listened back to, there's a little bit of a hiss on the line, a little bit of a clicking. I'm really sorry about that, but we only had one chance. I've only got one recording, so I hope that you can bear through it. It's not too bad, but it is there. So hopefully you'll enjoy it nonetheless. That's going to come up right after this. So, in a bit of a departure, we're recording this week's podcast on location in Portcullis House in Westminster. We're proving that politics and sport do mix. I'm in the office of Ed Miliband. Ed, welcome. Thanks very much for doing this.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be here. So I usually give my guests a bit of an introduction, but I'm going to assume that people know who you are, certainly our English listeners.
They might be wondering why I'm on your podcast.
Well, that's what we're going to come on to. So we were just saying when I came in here, you've got a really nice picture on your wall of Dave Roberts famously laying out on his stomach, sliding into second base during game four of the 2004 ALCS. So you're a Red Sox fan. Tell us how that happened.
Start with 2004?
Let's start with 2004 and work.
Oh, 2004. I mean, it just sort of... What can you say about 2004? I think I'll be here for an hour. 2004 is the sort of culmination of every Red Sox fan's agony. As your listeners will, I'm sure, know, the Red Sox were 3-0 down to the Yankees in the American League Championship Series. No team had ever come back from 3-0 down. The photo I've got, which is signed by Dave Roberts, is of his steal. Kevin Millar walked in the bottom of the ninth with the Red Sox down 4-3. Dave Roberts was the pinch runner. He'd only recently, I think, come over from Los Angeles to play for the Red Sox. He was a sort of bench player, you know, and he had a totally material effect on this 86-year curse because he stole second base and then scored the tying run in the bottom of the ninth, and the Red Sox went on to win that game in extra innings. And what is amazing about that, and I rewatched a particular steal last night, is that every time I watch it, I think he's going to be out. Even 13 years later, I sort of think he's going to be out. Because I don't know whether people remember this, but I've watched it enough times to remember this. Mariano Rivera was, storied, famed, probably the best relief pitcher of all time, was pitching. And three times Mariano Rivera throws back to first base. And the third time, they nearly got him. And he steals second base then after the third time. Jorge Posada is the Yankees catcher. And he is not out. I mean, he's safe by a matter of inches, which is why I keep thinking whenever I watch it on a replay, you know, even all these years later, he's going to be out. Anyway, so he steals the base. Bill Miller hits a single. He comes home. I confess I was not watching it live. I watched Game 7 live, mm-hmm. because I just knew Game 7 was going to be historic.
Yeah, I was going to ask you where you were. Were you in the Treasury?
I was in London. No. I must have been. That's true. I was working in the Treasury. But I remember reading, you know, feeling incredibly depressed because I'd read in the newspapers the next day. Or maybe see on the internet that Would I have seen it on the internet? Maybe on the internet. Yeah, they were 3-0. That they were 3-0 down. They were going to lose, etc. It was all. I think at that point I was still buying the Herald Tribune to kind of read it properly, and thought that's it. And then stayed up to watch Game 7 when they came back to 3-3 and then 1-4-3. And then the kind of World Series was a sort of walk in the park.
Yeah, it was 4-0, of course, yeah. As Curt Schilling famously said. So how did your love of the Red Sox start? You lived in Boston.
My dad taught in Boston when I was seven, initially. And so I sort of got a little bit into it when I was seven, although I don't then remember the extraordinary sort of collapse of 1978. I don't think I was living there by that point. I wasn't. And I didn't follow it that closely. But then I came back in the extraordinary collapse in 78 when they were miles ahead in the pennant and the Yankees caught them and then they had a one-off playoff and Bucky Dent hit the home run and it was sort of a... it's one of the many sort of disasters that has befallen the Red Sox. And then I was back there in 1982 and that was when I really got... For 3 months, staying with my dad. And that was when I really got kind of hooked on them. The interesting thing is that part of what was so... What was and less so now, actually, for obvious reasons, but... What was so alluring about them was, in a way, their disasters. The fact they'd come so close. You know, they were this sort of nearly team.
Yeah.
And there was something about them being this nearly team that made it so captivating. And in 1986, which is the disaster I sort of the most etched on my mind, I was with my mum, actually, in Paris. I guess it must have been a half term or something. And I stayed up in the middle of the night to listen to the game 6, I think, against the Mets in the World Series, which was the game where they were going to win. And I remember, as a 16-year-old listening to this, and as they were saying, right, so I think they were 5-3 up in the. I didn't remember this, but I looked back last night. In the 11th inning, and the announcer was saying, right, well, the Red Sox are basically going to win. You know, that's it. They've won the World Series. And I remember feeling this sense of great joy, but also thinking, God, you know, that's it now. They've sort of done it. And of course, then they didn't. Mm-hmm. And the ball went through Bill Buckner's legs. And, you know, and so, in a way, then the disaster of 86, which was so unbelievable, sort of made the kind of. Sense of have they got to win at some point, all the more sort of captivating.
Mm-hmm. So who were your guys then at that time in the 1980s? Was it Wade Boggs?
Jim Rice. Jim Rice is the one I remember. Wade Boggs, I remember.
Roger Clemens.
Roger Clemens. Bill Buckner was sort of relatively popular until he wasn't.
And how did you follow it in the 80s and 90s?
There was a thing called American Forces Network. The American Forces Network. And it was like, you know, it was the worst reception you could ever imagine on a radio station. It would cut in and out. I think it was on medium wave, and you'd have to just sort of fine-tune the radio and try and get... And you'd sort of hear, you know, 2 out of 3 words. But it was pretty hard. It was pre-internet, so it was pretty hard to follow.
And you... Obviously followed it through the 90s where the curse wasn't broken. And then you were in Boston 2002, 2003.
And that was a gut-wrenching. I mean, that was absolutely gut-wrenching because... And, you know, in a way, you can see the sort of seeds of the curse being reversed in 2003 in retrospect because they nearly hired Billy Beane as the general manager.
Yeah.
And I remember... I was studying at this place called the Center for European Studies in Harvard, and I remember this person who was a big Red Sox fan saying to me, God, it's incredibly exciting, they're going to hire Billy Beane. Mm-hmm. And then they didn't. And then they put Theo Epstein in charge at the age of 28 or something. Mm-hmm. And then in 2003, they, of course, it was in Game 7, wasn't it, of the American League Championship Series where they were beating the Yankees.
Yep.
And Grady Little... the manager made the terrible mistake of leaving Pedro Martinez in the 8th inning, and I remember I was around at these friends' house, and one friend who's sadly no longer alive, who's a long-suffering Red Sox fan, And I remember he was listening on the radio while watching on the while we were watching on the television. He's saying, Joe and Jerry, who were the commentators, said, oh, Joe and Jerry are saying the champagne's on ice, you know. And I was like, oh, shut up about the champagne, you know, we're not there yet. And then indeed the wheels came off and they lost, and then Aaron Boone hit this home run in the 11th inning. And I mean, that was just, it was just sort of, it was kind of unbelievable, really. I mean, the sort of trail of disasters, which became known, and we were discussing this just before we came on air, but the curse of the Bambino, which mm-hmm. is to do with the selling of Babe Ruth in 1918.
Yeah.
But it was only christened the curse of the Bambino in 1990, I think, by mm-hmm. Dan Shaughnessy. But it was a remarkable run of nearly making it. But then, and also the other great thing about them is there's such a sort of incredible sort of history. So that, you know, 1975, Fisk's home run to tie the World Series mm-hmm. to make it 3-3, and then of course they lost in Game 7. But in a way, Fisk's home run is more fame, and the one that just goes to the right side of the foul pole.
Yeah, he's willing it in.
Yeah, is more famous than anything that happened in Game 7, because mm-hmm. it was such a sort of extraordinary moment. Mm-hmm. So your Fenway Park is a lovely ground.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I was going to ask what attracted you. Was it Fenway? Was it the stories?
There's something about the fact also you come into Boston and you come in from the airport, and if you're in a taxi from the airport and you pass the Green Monster, mm-hmm. and there is something about the Green Monster and Fenway and all of that. And you know, there was talk at some point of a decade or so ago of them moving away from Fenway, and this ownership decided not to, and I think mm-hmm. it's really good they didn't. So you know, it's just such a sort of, it's kind of an amazing history. And actually, you know, there were some upsides and some downsides to being Labour leader, but one upside was that I met John Henry and Tom Werner, the owners, because they were in London at some friends of some friends, and they kind of knew I was a Red Sox fan. So I got to meet them and basically bore them rigid by talking to them about, you know, it was just after 2013, I think, when they unexpectedly won the World Series in 2013.
So was it just you sitting here like you are with me now?
There were a few other people there, but I think I basically bored the other people rigid by just going, asking them sort of a million questions about, I think Theo had just gone, and you know, just about sort of being the owners and what it was like and so on. And there is something about baseball as a game which, and I'm a cricket fan, and so I love cricket and my kids love cricket, although I'm hoping to get them into baseball, but there is something about baseball which is this extraordinary ability for it to turn on the sixpence mm-hmm. with one pitch.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't a Red Sox story, but the Kirk Gibson home run in the world, the game one of the World Series. Do you know this one?
I probably should.
You should know this.
I do know it, yes.
This is where Kirk Gibson comes in as a pinch hitter for the Dodgers in game one of 88. Exactly, 88.
Of course I do.
And the commentator says, and
it's on one leg.
Yeah, well, yeah. he's limping on both legs because he's got two legs wrong with him, and he comes in as a pinch hitter, and he hits a home run to win the game, and in a way it's only game one, but then the Dodgers win the series, and you know, it's just this in 86, again little remembered because of the Mets disaster. The Red Sox were down to their last pitch against the Angels in the American League Championship Series, down three games to one, mm-hmm. and they won. And they kind of someone hit a home run on the Dave. I'm searching for the name. Somebody will know.
Somebody
sorry, Dave, hits a home run, and it's just sort of, you know, it's just that, it's just, you know, and some baseball games are quite boring, but when it's a blowout, but, and you know, the amazing thing about 2004 is, you know, the Red Sox have lost three games, they get absolutely stuffed by the Yankees, like 17-5, some like terrible score, in game three, and it looks like they're completely stuffed and done, and they're going to lose, and that's, and you know, that is what sort of, you know, that's what's so
exciting about it because it has the ability to chase. And then, you know, they win game one, and I remember Kevin Millar saying after, you know, after game three, maybe, don't let us win one game. If we win one game, we'll win the series. And, you know, then they sort of gradually inch back. It's the 12th inning and then the 14th inning, and it's like the longest games in World Series history. Yeah. And then you know, Curt Schilling and the bloody sock in the game six. And then I think by game seven, it's the sort of although all Red Sox fans thought it's not gonna it's gonna go wrong, you know, it's so you know, it's just got an incredible drama to it. The drama is amazing.
Yeah, there's something sort of poetic about it always, wherever you turn.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's not often that we've got a politician on our podcast. So I said to you before we started that we'll talk a bit about the Red Sox, and then, as I said at the outro intro, where sport and politics do mix. So I wanted to ask you a few questions about baseball and policy and how they cross over, because I thought it would be interesting to hear your view. The first one, this is sort of
I think you'll be much more sophisticated than this than me. Sure, I'm just an escapist fan, really.
Well, I thought you were a deep thinker about it.
No, maybe. Well, let's see. I might be about to be destroyed, I think.
The first one's slightly tongue-in-cheek. I wondered if there's any constituency for an all-party parliamentary group on baseball. Like, are you a lone sentinel?
I think there is, actually.
So who else should I be tapping up?
There is a Conservative MP called Alex Shelbrook, who is, I think, is the motivator behind it. But there is some talk, actually. I saw this the other day. That there's some talk of Major League Baseball being played in the UK at some point.
It's
going to
happen. 2019, June 2019. It was in the conditional bargaining agreement last year.
Do we know who it's going to be?
There's a few rumours about, but I don't know.
They're not going to get the Red Sox and the Yankees, you don't think?
It turns out
the Celtics were here. The Boston Celtics were here.
Yeah, last week, yeah.
They didn't invite you. Well, it passed me by until after it happened. Or actually, in fact, it fell out on the day it happened. I heard somebody on the radio saying, of course, the Boston Celtics are playing here tonight. And I thought, wow. I mean, I could bore on to you about the Boston Celtics and Larry Bird at great length as well.
That was rather better in the 1980s following the Celtics than it was the Red Sox.
It was. And actually, you know, the worst of all was following the Patriots. I mean, you know, it's the most extraordinary turnaround. The Red Sox were my sort of primary love, and the, I suppose, Celtics and Patriots were second.
Okay. So you talked a bit about how being leader of the Labour Party allowed you to meet John Henry and Tom Werner, but you also got to go to the White House, I mean, famously several times. Was baseball ever part of the conversation that you were having? Not necessarily with President Obama, but I know Josh Earnest, for example, is a huge Kansas City Royals fan. Heard him talking about them at length. Was there anyone that you were getting in here?
I know. I had the only person I've talked about it in that context is David Axelrod, who I think, God, maybe if I get this wrong, he'll kill me. I think he's a big Cubs fan.
Okay.
Because I'm the Cubs or the White Sox.
Yeah.
But he did a long profile of Theo Epstein, I think for The New Yorker or something. So I talked to him about that, and I've sort of said to him often, you know, it'd be great to go to a game with him. But I don't know. It's funny you should say this, because when I, in game in 2013, I stayed up all night for the victory in the
game six
of the World Series, and I did lots of tweets about it. And then, you know, I sort of got slightly attacked by my political opponents, for sort of, you know, doing tweets at 3 o'clock in the morning, which of course these days from a world leader like Donald Trump is entirely kind of expected. And also, like, oh, why is he following baseball? Anyway, so I don't know. The answer is I didn't really talk to Obama about baseball. I'm sorry to disappoint. But did talk to Axelrod about it.
Well, you know, if you can't get Obama, get the money, talks into his ear. Why not? So I said before we started, there's a few questions that I wanted to talk to you about, where I think baseball, there's some interesting social, maybe policy issues.
Yeah, well, definitely.
Sort of wander into it. So the first one, I mean, you of course are a social democrat yourself. You were in Harvard teaching a social justice module in 2003. Yeah. So baseball as a sport is, if you like, it's about as close to a socialist sport as you can get. You know, the players have a role in negotiations, the transfer of capital to labour, you know, social democratic principles, if you will.
along with the sort of salaries of $20 million.
Well, absolutely.
You know, I mean, everyone should have salaries of $20 million. That's what you're saying.
It's a very corrupted view. I don't think it's a view of communism that Stalin would recognise.
No, or sort of... Anyway, but carry on.
I kind of was wondering, why were you not talking about baseball on the stump between 2010 and 2015?
You think it might have been a vote? You think it might have been a vote winner?
I think it would have been, yeah.
I'm not sure I see it as a great sort of social democratic or socialist model. I hadn't quite sort of thought about it in that way. But just explain this to me. Explain to me the sort of lefty aspects of it, that the players have control.
Well, to a degree, certainly since free agency in the 70s with Marvin Miller, the players have a proper stake in the negotiations.
Right.
They are an active participant and they can and do strike quite regularly in order to get the salaries that they want, the reforms that they want. There's also, if you will, an attempt to create balance within the system. So, you know, draft picks go to the worst teams in order to try and restore competitive balance. The monies are redistributed between the Red Sox.
I mean, there is a point there. I'm not sure it's a model for society, but I mean, there is a point there which America seems to take more seriously the need to sort of even things up year on year,
mm-hmm.
both in American football, where the draft is obviously more important, I think, than because of the college system. And things like the salary cap, the penalty that you get for going over, is it salary cap or total salary bill cap, and penalty you get for that. So I'm sure there is stuff for football and other things to learn.
Mm.
I'm sure that's true.
But it's not in no way something that sort of attracted you to the sport. You weren't in the minutiae of the...
I wish I could claim that was why I was sort of... I was more attracted by, Carl Yastrzemski. And, I actually saw Yastrzemski. It wasn't his 3,000th hit, but I remember I was there for his 3,300th hit.
Wow.
Fenway. I think that might have been one of the first games I think I might have gone to a game when I was 7, but the games there was a game I remember where I may turn out to be historically wrong about this, about when it occurred, but I remember my memory is when it was I was 12 and that was the game.
Oh, fantastic. So yeah, it's more Carl Yastrzemski than
Karl Marx. Yeah.
Yeah. very well put.
Yeah.
So I was going to sort of, by extension of that, you mentioned salary caps there. There's obviously been when we were exchanging messages about this, you suggested we have a hot stove show, and we certainly can't have one of those because nothing's happening. And a lot of the suggestion is that it's because of the way the market's working. It's because there is a cap on salaries now, albeit not in name. So
you'll be following this more closely than I have, but have the Yankees not signed Giancarlo Stanton?
Yeah, but that was by trade. It wasn't,
it
wasn't a free market acquisition.
Right.
So.
And the Red Sox are holding out for J.D. Martinez.
Yeah, yeah. But none of the big players, Arrieta, Martinez, Eric Hosmer, none of the big
And why is that?
Well, the suggestion is that all of the teams are becoming more savvy about the money that they've got available. Essentially, the bargaining agreement was essentially a soft cap, if you will. There are huge punitive penalties if you go over that now. And teams like the Dodgers, the Yankees, the Giants, and the Red Sox, to a lesser extent, are trying to stay within that. So again,
By the way, I've suddenly remembered somebody who is more of an enthusiast than I am, who has gotten an Obama kitchen, and that is Samantha Power.
Okay.
Because I met Samantha Power in 2003, and get this, she used to, I don't know whether she's allowed, she goes to spring training.
Wow.
Now, I think somebody who goes to spring training in Florida to watch the Red Sox, that is a sort of level of commitment.
Yeah.
Goes way beyond. I've never been to spring training.
No. How often do you get to Fenway?
Well, I haven't been to Fenway for absolutely ages.
Yeah.
I mean, I do want to go, and actually, Tom Werner, who I'm sort of in touch with every so often, he sort of says to me, you should come. So I do want to.
You've got an open
invite. I do want to go. I'm sort of slightly targeting. I'm trying to persuade my wife this is a good idea. I'm slightly targeting opening day.
Okay.
But I don't know quite whether I'm going to sort of pull it off for family reasons.
So have the boys not had their first Fenway?
No, they haven't. They haven't.
Well, that would be a good way
to
start.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, if you're there in June, maybe we can go to a game together.
Are you going
to
be there in June?
I'll be there in the first week of June.
Are you going?
I'm going, yeah.
Are you a Red Sox fan?
I am a Red Sox fan. Yeah.
Oh, I see.
I am, yeah.
God, I didn't realise that. That's a rather obvious point.
Well,
so when did you first get into it?
2003. So you and I shared that heartbreak that we were talking about earlier.
You've had much less heartbreak than I have.
I have, I'm afraid. But, you know.
Do you see, I think there's an interesting point in this, which is, I don't want to hijack your other more serious questions, but does did following the Red Sox become less exciting after they won? And I sort of slightly fear that it did.
I think it probably did. I think you're probably a better person to ask that question than me.
Yeah.
Because I onboarded at a time that they just won, basically. Yeah. So 2002, 2003, as I was saying to you earlier, when I started university and started in earnest watching it very regularly, I fell into the Red Sox because they were basically on the television for no better reason than that. And they had Pedro and Nomar. And if you weren't following those guys and getting involved in it, then you wouldn't. I think you're right. I think the fact that they won three times in 10 years possibly cheapens it. If they'd won once...
They're like a normal team. And I suppose it's what the Cubs is like. Yeah. You know, now that the Cubs have sort of... I'm just trying to persuade Axelrod to introduce me to Theo, because I'd like to meet Theo, because I sort of think, you know... I mean, what he has done is extraordinary.
He's clearly a genius.
He clearly is a genius of some kind.
Yeah.
I think the other thing, by the way, just to think about why I was attracted to it... And I think this is why my kids might quite like it too, is the sort of maths of it.
Mm.
Because I was quite a maths...
Yeah,
I was quite into maths as a kid.
Yeah.
And somehow all of the averages... And I mean, the Americans do the stats so brilliantly.
Mm.
You know, now they have sort of sabermetric stats and all of that, you know. You know, it's just... You could sort of spend hours looking at the... different statistics and all that, which I don't think football, even for these days, British football doesn't do quite in the same way.
I think some of them have sort of proprietary data, don't they? But you never hear about it. It's not a hobby. People aren't out there crunching the numbers in the way that, you know, Bill James famously was back in the 70s and 80s whilst he was a janitor.
And the Michael Lewis book is Moneyball is just a brilliant.
Yeah,
you know, even if you don't care about baseball, it's sort of so exciting and interesting about, and that's where there is politics, which is. The Michael Lewis book is basically saying these are imperfect markets. You know, because of the way the stats were done, walks weren't properly sort of taken account of in the batting average. They were undervalued by the market. Mm-hmm. You know, something that the Red Sox have, I think, made part of their thing, and which Nomar was very bad at, and always used to frustrate me, is wearing out the pitcher. I mean, Nomar always used to swing at the bloody first pitch.
Yeah.
And seems to be often, and you know, so there is a sort of market imperfections thing going on.
So you were Dustin Pedroia fan, if you like, a guy that wears a picture.
And Hanley often swings for the first pitch as well, so he can be slightly frustrating.
Yeah, well, the suggestion was last year that was turning on its head. Jose Altuve, of course, was the MVP, and if anyone swings at the first pitch,
is that right?
Then it's him.
Oh, right. Well, actually, you'll be on me on that.
Well, that's everyone's expecting you to be wearing out the pitcher, so if he puts a lollipop up there and knock it through the gap, that's
the way that the fashion changes. Yeah. Exactly, the fashion sort of changes.
I was going to ask you about that specifically. I'm not a mathematician. I've never been a statistician until really I became interested in baseball, and I see a lot of interest in that. I basically have taught myself not to do deep regression analysis. I'm not applying for jobs in the Red Sox front office, but I can do a pivot.
Oh, God, I would love a job in the Red Sox front office. Honestly, maybe we could ask for a job share.
Maybe. Well, you know Tom Ward. Yeah.
Maybe.
Pop him an email.
Yeah. Exactly.
So do you think that that's something that we could use as a way to get younger people in and maybe to teach applied mathematics, because that's a thing that's difficult, you know, when you're in school, how do you teach kids mathematics in a way that they'll understand it? But it's unfortunate, I guess, that baseball is not a proprietary sport here.
Agree with you, and, you know, even cricket as well, okay, it doesn't have quite the stats of baseball. But, you know, I noticed that particularly my older son is really interested in the maths of it and the stats. So definitely, and I'm sure that is a... I don't know whether you can use baseball to teach maths here, but it's definitely a side benefit, I would say. I think the other politics, just to mention, because you did ask about it, it just occurs to me, you know, just to big up the Red Sox ownership a little bit, you know... Boston has a not glorious history in relation to black players.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
And what happened under the Yorkie ownership. And at the time of, I think it was Charlottesville and Trump, John Henry came out and said, I think we should rename Yorkie Way and get rid of the Yorkie name.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know quite whether that is happening.
I think it is happening,
And I thought that was pretty... And I actually sent him a message saying... I thought that was a pretty good thing to have done because that I don't remember that era. Mm-hmm. I remember the era of the Yorkies, but not the particular colour bar and
Tom
all.
Tom Yorkie was probably just about when he was dead
but I sort of think, so I think, you know, recognising those kind of things about, you know, the Boston history is kind of important and not, shouldn't be just airbrushed out.
It leads me on to another question I wanted to ask you, and that's part of it, specifically about the Red Sox, but we're talking a bit about the politics of baseball, and you said, of course, that the Yorkie family not taking on Jackie Robinson, Willie Mays very famously, but more currently, it does seem to be a sport that's dominated by a politics that maybe you would not identify with, specifically looking at Curt Schilling, who came up in our conversation earlier on, who's certainly an outlier, but it's a very Republican-dominated sport. I recall last season, Brian Dozier, who's the Twins star player, very smart guy. I've heard him interviewed, really, really nice, intelligent guy, appearing on Essential Talk, which is Kevin Millar's show, wearing a MAGA hat poorly disguised with a Twins logo. So how do you feel about that? I mean, I sometimes wonder what I'm doing, spending my time watching these guys who I wouldn't like to go for a beer with.
I mean, my sporting heroes have been Jeff Boycott, who clearly does not have my political views, quite apart from anything else.
Quite.
Tom Brady, friend of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is.
Does it not occur to you? Is it not there? You know, Wade Boggs famously gives a lot of money to the Republicans.
Does he really? I don't
know.
Yeah,
amongst others, I think.
I mean, John Henry and Tom Werner are definitely Democrats.
As is Theo Epstein.
Yeah. As is Theo Epstein. Yeah. So I don't know. That's my defense. Look, I don't know. I think it's. I'm not somebody who says sport and politics should be completely separate, but I think it's quite... If you had to pick your sports teams on the basis of the politics of the sports stars, you got some issues.
Yeah, I think I fundamentally agree with that. I just wondered if...
You have to try and... I don't know if it doesn't sound terrible. You have to sort of slightly compartmentalise... I mean, look, compartmentalise it within limits. I mean, you've got to have a bottom line. Mm, but mm. I mean, I was quite pleased that Brady seems to have slightly distanced himself from Trump. He didn't go to the White House ceremony.
Mm, yeah, I believe so. Yeah,
and also, you know, well, I don't think it can be completely separate. I don't think it can be completely separate. So it is. It's sort of an issue. And then football has its own. American football has its own problems of the brain injuries and so on.
Mm. Another thing, I mean, when you were the leader of the Labour Party, one of the things that was sort of a policy marker for you, if you will, was sort of social and responsible capitalism.
Yeah.
A bit more interventionist in terms of who was doing what.
Yeah, you seem to think baseball is responsible capitalism.
Well, I don't know. Not necessarily so. So I was going to...
Responsible-ish.
I was going to ask you about an example of that. So the Miami Marlins changed hands this summer. So a Derek Jeter-led consortium now runs the Miami Marlins and have immediately started trading off all of their best players in order to reduce the payroll and make more money, essentially. Oh, some of them, there's a frontier capitalist.
So it's okay to hate Derek Jeter again then.
Yeah, well, it's always okay to hate Derek Jeter, but
I sort of got more sympathetic towards Derek Jeter towards the end as he was getting older,
as
but
he was getting bad. Yeah,
well, as he was getting bad, exactly. But maybe I shouldn't have done. Yeah,
so I wondered about, I mean, you may have a thought about that, you know. Do, and Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, has had quite a lot of criticism for essentially allowing that takeover to go through without any checks and balances. I mean, is it from your point of view, as a person who
God.
Said some of these things maybe 5 years ago,
I don't know anything about the Marlins case, but look, I think in all sport, and I think English football too, there is an issue about what a responsible owner is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I can't speak for baseball because I just don't know enough about it, but I do know that I think, you know, I think there probably aren't enough sort of checks and balances in relation to some sports, including football, as to what, you know, responsibility and it can't just be about money. And the problem is that a lot of these sports, because there is so much money involved, are about an arms race.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, that is definitely unfortunate.
Yeah, sort of bringing it back a little closer to home. So we've mentioned several times throughout the course of this conversation, of course, that baseball is very much a minority sport in this country.
Yeah.
Just wanted to get your thoughts on the funding of a sport like baseball. So Baseball Softball UK, which runs the, you know, is the overseeing body for the two sports in the UK, gets about £1 million a year in right. terms of its settlement, and that's for everyone from the elite programs, GB baseball team, to, you know, you and I having a knockabout in the yeah. park. Where are you on that continuum in terms of funding elite sport and participatory sport? Do you, is it something that
look,
you
I
think
participation is sort of important. I mean, I'm not. I don't think I'm particularly saying we've got to fund baseball. I don't know the details of baseball funding, but I certainly think funding grassroots sport is important. But look, I think there's lots of issues around the funding of, you know, cricket, playing fields, all of that stuff. So, you know, even football. So I think, I don't know, I don't have a kind of strong view about where baseball should be in the queue. You know, I'm just a sort of...
Just a fan.
I'm just a sort of armchair fan, really. And actually, look, the great thing about MLB.com is that, you know, you can watch... I mean, it's also terrible because you could spend sort of many hours mm. watching... What is it? You can watch every game.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
Every game of every team.
Yeah.
For sort of not that much per a subscription per year.
Yeah, one of my colleagues worked this out, what the value for money was, and I think he worked it out that it was something like 60 pence a game.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty good, isn't it?
A year for a subscription of 100 quid or yeah. whatever it is.
No, it's pretty good.
So yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe that's how the government should subsidise baseball. Is
but I think we should lobby for the Red Sox and Yankees coming.
Yeah,
coming here. I mean, that'd be quite good to have a Red Sox Yankees game here.
Well, you've
I mean,
got the contacts.
Yeah, maybe I will. Maybe I'll say, look, you should. You'll find a ready. I mean, do you think there'd be? A, presumably, you must know from your podcast there will be a market for people to come on.
I would think so. I mean, so the NFL has obviously been extraordinarily successful. I think that the numbers dipped a little this year. They've maybe found their level of tolerance in terms of people's understanding of it, but it's much more present in people's lives. It's on Sky Sports, for example, whereas baseball at yeah. the moment it's hidden away on a dark corner of BT.
Right.
And if there's a French League 2 match in football, they won't put it on, so people don't stumble upon it. But nevertheless, I think if you do it in London, then it would have enough of a draw as a novelty, at least in the first instance. I think I'm like you. I think they need to get some of the marquee teams in there early, because people will go to watch the New York Yankees because they've got the cap, right?
Exactly.
So yeah, maybe we should. Maybe that's it. We should make this episode not just a conversation with you, but the start of a lobby to get the Red Sox and Yankees.
We want a Red Sox and Yankees game. If the Major League Baseball is listening, that is the message.
Well, I know the team who run it here in the UK, or maybe I can put them in your direction.
Definitely.
That's a deal.
Definitely.
Okay, so that's just about all we've got time for. But lastly, you said that you might be in Boston on a weekday. I've got an alternative for you.
Yeah.
There's a group of fans down here in London who organise meetups in the pub to watch games. So the 31st of March, if you're not in Boston... Can I put them in?
Oh, and of course, the 31st of March is not the home opener, is it?
Oh, it's not. No.
No, that is right. Okay.
So
well,
you
look,
can
I
do
will.
Both.
Okay. Well, I will definitely do my best.
Ed, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you this morning. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I'm glad.